Good morning, friends and family and brothers and sisters. It's good to be back with you again. In some ways, it feels like a lot more than 10 months, and in some ways, it feels like a lot less. But your friendly faces look, it's a blessing to be here with you. Share this time together. The title of the message this morning is On Wings as Eagles. I'd like to start by reading Isaiah 40, verse 31. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. Isn't that beautiful? Doesn't that just send a chill down your spine? They that wait upon the Lord. How many times do I have eagle's wings? And how many times am I more like a turkey buzzard? How many times am I riding on the clouds? And how many times am I slogging in the mud? Jesus said, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and its fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by his fruit. We often apply that to people around us. It's a little more challenging when we aim that at ourselves. Because what would be a sign of corrupt fruit in me or a lack of eagle's wings? How about discouragement? Do eagles ever get discouraged? Just feeling like life is too big and too much. And that promise in Isaiah that sounds so beautiful, it's something that people talk about and that preachers read in church, but to actually have eagle's wings? We just wish we could. So let's take a quick assessment. Do I have eagle's wings? Is that a description of my life? Am I waiting on the Lord? And is that power and that spirit and that joy, that abundant life, is that within me? Or is there something else? One of the things that's true about the way most of us live our lives is that when we don't get what we think we should get, when we're doing what we think we should be doing, we go back and we try to do the same things harder. Or better. And we think, well, surely I glitched somewhere in this process. There's got to be eagle's wings in here somewhere. And we do the same thing again. Still a buzzard. I'd like to propose four things this morning that I think are a cycle. Maybe you can call them an updraft. An eagle's updraft that can take them up. Four things that can help us, no matter where we are in our lives, to soar as eagles. I'll just briefly name them here, and then we'll go into them. God can do a work in your life that is above your ability to imagine and above your power to perform. You can't even imagine. You could never do it. And God can do it in you. That's true. You with buzzard's wings. You can experience the fruit of the Spirit, number two, at every stage in your life. Because it's not you. It's the fruit of the Spirit. You can have it. Right now. Whatever you're going through. Number three, if you lose your peace with God, that's on you. It wasn't your circumstances. It wasn't the people around you. It wasn't God. That's on you. You let it go. Number four, if you lose your love for your brothers, that's on you. It wasn't them. It wasn't your circumstances. You had to let it go. So many of us want to change our lives for the better, and we don't realize that buzzards can't become eagles. Even a very, very, very good buzzard is not an eagle. And yet so many times what we try to do is we try to do a work in our life using Bible language, using religious jargon, to try to do a work of redemption in our lives. And the beauty of the work of God is that he's the one who does that work. And it's not until we give up that process to him that the caterpillar becomes the butterfly, that the buzzard changes entirely and he dies and becomes an eagle. I'd like to tell you a little bit of a story. I'd heard rumors about it, and I heard the story in person just recently, and it's sort of become my new favorite story. The man's name is Brother Gheorghe. He is in our church in Romania. He's gray-haired. He's got bushy beard, and he's 63 years old. He's got prison tattoos on his hands. He's got a rough, gentle voice. And I knew he had a story, and I heard bits and pieces of the story, but the other day, I got the privilege of riding with him all day when he was doing what he does. He does mission work with the Roma gypsies in Romania. And so he told me his story as we went along. Gheorghe was just a young boy when he was given up to the orphanage, just at the local orphanage there in our section of Romania. He never met his father. His father was a German. And from the time that his mother abandoned him at a very young age, he never saw her again until he was 40 years old. He grew up in orphanages, which were more like prisons than anything else. And he grew up angry. And he grew up mean. And the orphanages would shuttle him from place to place because nobody could tame him. He was a fighter. And everywhere he went, he would get in fights. And so they would send him to worse and worse orphanages. And finally, when he was 12 years old, the worst of the lot expelled him and said, they're done with him. He can't do anything more with Gheorghe. And so there was an intervening time when he was adopted for a while by a family who knew his mother. And the mother of that family, his adoptive family, was a witch. And literally a witch. And that's the environment that he was in for several years until she died. Then we went back to the third final orphanage, and then they eventually kicked him out. And so he was on the streets. And so he grew up in gypsy enclaves, and he grew up very mean. He's not very tall, but he's very, very strong. And he would go into bars, thank you, and find the biggest man, and then have people place bets on what would happen if they fight. Or arm wrestle. Sometimes it was one, sometimes it was another. And he almost always won the bets. He'd beat them up. And he's developed quite a reputation for himself. Never, ever, ever make Gheorghe mad. He will hurt you. One day he was, he had gone to a gym, and he was fighting in a gym, and a man walked in the back and saw him up there, and he had just, the man he was fighting had made him mad, and he clamped onto his ear and bit off a chunk of the man's ear, and was spitting out the ear and blood. And this man in the back said, "Hey, who's that boy?" And he was about 17 at this time. And they said, "Well, he's crazy." He said, "I want him for the Romanian Olympic team." And so he took him and he started training him. He trained him to fight. And so what was a mean boy became a mean, skilled boy. And he would go out and pick fights on people and just hurt them for the joy of hurting them. But he said it was a terrible, terrible time in his life. He was so full of anger and full of just this rage and darkness. Unfortunately for him, he didn't know when to turn it off. And so he was having a bout in a city down in southern Romania, and between training and the bout, he went out into the city and he beat somebody up he shouldn't have beat up, and he ended up in jail. And that was the end of his Olympic career. And so he bounced around in jail for a while. Eventually came back up to Suceava, and he set himself up in the local bazaar, which is a big sprawling area there in Suceava. It's a large marketplace. And he set himself up as a local boss. And he would go around, and he set up what's called a protection racket. Do any of you boys know what a protection racket is? It works like this. Preston, right? Marshall. Marshall goes to Danny, and Marshall says, "Danny, Danny's a shop owner. He has a little shop there in the market." And he says, "Danny, I'm going to protect you from all the bad guys. You just have to pay me $20 a month, and I'll protect you." And Danny says, "Well, I don't need protection." And he says, "Yes, you do. You need it from me, if nobody else." And so he goes around and he collects money from all the Dannys in the marketplace. And anybody who didn't pay up got beat up. And so that was how he made his money. And he had to break bones every once in a while to make sure that people knew that he meant what he said. And so he did. If he needed to break some bones, he broke some bones. And that was his life. He had to pay the police off. And then he also had little mobs of pickpockets and people that would go into the marketplace, and they would pick people's pockets and steal their money, and then they would all give him a little bit. He could keep some of it, but most of it went to Gheorghe. The rest of it went to the police, so the police wouldn't bother them. And that was his life. Drinking and smoking and beating people up. Somehow he got married to, or he started living with this girl. And they had a couple children, a little boy and a little girl. And she, at one point, back in the early 90s, met up with some Christians. And sort of, and she started talking about church. Well, one day, Gheorghe was back in jail again. He had done something, I don't know what landed him in jail this time. He'd spent multiple times in jail over the years. He was in jail, and unlike Joseph in the Bible, who was such an outstanding character that the jailer put him in charge of prison, Gheorghe was such a bad character that the jailer put him in charge of prison. So what they would do, the way they would run the prison, was they would take the person who was the most vicious of them, who would sort of rise to the top of the hierarchy, the jail hierarchy, and they would put him in charge of the prisoners. And so every time somebody would come into jail, Gheorghe would go and he would find out who he was and steal his stuff from him and tell him where he's supposed to stay and put him in his place. And one day, in comes this young Christian man into jail. And he was just in his early 20s, and he was scared as could be, and he comes into prison. What had happened is he had killed somebody on the street. He had a wreck, a vehicle accident. And in Romania, if you have an accident, at least back then, if you have an accident and kill somebody and it's your fault, you go to jail. And that's what happened with him. And so he's a very small fish in a very big pond, and he comes trembling into prison, and Gheorghe finds him, and he says, "Okay, let's see your stuff." And so Gheorghe takes his stuff and dumps it all out in the bed, and he says, "What's this?" And he says, "He has a Bible in there." And the man said, that's the Bible. He said, I heard about these. Give it to me. And the man said, well, my mom gave it to me. And Gyorgy takes it and he whops him on the head. And he said, well, I gave you that. And you give it to me. So he takes and he reads the Bible. And he started just sort of reading at random, but he got hooked in the Gospels. And so he started reading the Gospels. And I think he was reading in the book of Mark, he said. And he read through the book of Mark, and he was really engaged with this man, Jesus, that he was reading about. He really liked him. And he liked the way he was sort of, you know, the way he could talk to these Pharisees. And he liked the whole idea of what was going on. He was really on board with it. And then he gets to the end of the book, and they kill him. He's like, what kind of a book is this? And he was so mad. And he went to this little prisoner again, and he said, you tell me what's going on with this book. What kind of a book is this anyway? And so this boy was able to talk to him a little bit and tell him a little bit about Jesus. And he said, well, you need to understand this. And he told him the gospel story and what actually was going on. And had him read the book of 1 John. And Gyorgy said from that time, it's not like he switched in a moment. It's not like that was a glorious conversion experience for him. But from that time on, the story of Jesus held him. He wasn't an eagle by any means. He was still very much turkey buzzard. But but the story of Jesus grabbed him and held him. And when his wife started talking about these Christian people, he started going to church too eventually. And so he went sort of sporadically for a while. And then he heard about, in my terms, he heard about eagle's wings. He heard about the power of the gospel. He heard about how Jesus can change lives. And he said, yeah, I want that too. I really want that. I want to clean my life up. He was miserable the way he was living. He didn't want to live that way anymore. So he started dressing differently. He started reading his Bible. He started going to church. He stopped drinking. He stopped smoking. He stopped going to bars. He stopped running around with his old friends. He had to give up his protection racket. No more free money. And one of the men from church got him a chainsaw. What didn't pay nearly as well as shaking people down, but he got a chainsaw and he started cutting firewood for people, and he'd earn a little money with his chainsaw for making firewood. And he was really enjoying what the Lord is doing in his life, and he was being changed. And he wanted it to be. He made a public statement. I want. In Romanian, they call it pocăință. Where I want to repent. I want to repent. I want to follow the Lord. I want to be a repentant one. And word got out. Gyorgy, did you hear about Gyorgy? Gyorgy's repented. He's going to church. And I said, Gyorgy, nah. Yeah. So by this time he had several little girls and Marius's little boy. And so he was working hard to make ends meet as an honest man. So he would run his chainsaw during the day, and at night he would work 12 hours as a night watchman. And so he was getting worn down. And one night he comes home after working all night. He came home about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he eats a little bite of breakfast or supper, and he gets ready to sleep a while, and then he's going to. Get up and run his chainsaw for the rest of the day until evening time and start it all over again. He had just laid down when upstairs in the apartment where they lived, up in the next floor up, he hears somebody turn the music up really loud. And he said, oh my, he's not going to be able to sleep. Lay there for a little bit. It's his cousin upstairs. He's going to go talk to him. So he went marching up the stairs. And he knocked on the door, and they let him in. And he said, "Hey, long night. They were in there drinking. They've been drinking all night. It tells you what kind of partiers they were. They've been drinking all night, and we're still drinking. It's 7 o'clock in the morning, playing music. That's the kind of people he had been hanging out with. He said, let me sleep for a couple hours, then I'll go. You guys can do whatever you want after that, but please turn the music down. Remember, you don't make Georgi mad. They said, yes, sir, Georgi, we'll turn it down. They turned it down. Anything for you, brother. They turned it down. And so he walks out, heads back down the stairs. Just got to the stairs. They cranked that thing right up to 10. And the building was throbbing. He's like, what in the world are those guys thinking? He turns back around, goes back, knocks on the door. Nobody answers. Tries the knob. It's locked. So Georgi goes downstairs. And he gets his chainsaw. And he comes back upstairs. And he cuts the door out. It's on the second floor. By the time he gets in there, there's nobody in there. Now, the men are all gone. But over in the corner is his cousin's wife with a little baby crouched in the corner. Afraid for her life. And he's like, what in the world did I do? Just hit him like... He's like, what would have I done if I would have caught those men? He was so mad. He would have taken that chainsaw to him. He knows he would have. Oh, what in the world just happened? Goes back downstairs. Of course, he can't sleep. Lies there for a while. Goes out and gets the door. Puts another door in the apartment. But he's just gutted. I thought that what I had was real. I thought I was a follower of Christ. What was that? That anger is still in there. He stopped coming to church. He wouldn't talk to anybody. He just would go away during the day. And the church people would come try to talk to him, and if he'd see their car out front, he wouldn't come around. He went to his cousin. He said, what in the world are you thinking? You know how I am. Why would you do that? And his cousin said, well, you said you were a Christian. We wanted to find out. Another level down. He said he felt like a stray dog because the pleasures that he had, that he hadn't liked at the time he had them, he had stopped doing them. He had stopped running around with these people. He had cut ties. He had stopped drinking. And he didn't have that, and he didn't have this. And he was just nowhere. He said it was a most black time of his life. He'd work all day long and then come sneaking home, hoping that he'd scout out the place, make sure nobody was there that could confront him. And the next morning early, he'd be gone again. One night he came home about a month later, looked carefully around. There's nobody there. He goes up in the apartment. The apartment's dark. Opens the apartment door, walks in, and here they're all waiting for him. A bunch of the men from church. And they said, hey, just hang on, Georgi. We want to talk to you. So they started talking to him. And they explained to him how God works in our lives. And just because we fall doesn't mean we're done. And he listened to him. And he said, okay, we're going to try this again. So he started coming back to church. But he knew something about himself now. He knew that there was something that was in there he hadn't known was still there. And so do you think he prayed different? Do you think he depended on the Lord different? Do you think he had more humility? He walked different, he prayed different, he lived different, he desperately sought after the Lord, knowing that in him was no good thing. And this went on for quite a while. And he felt a change. He felt a change. He felt the difference. He felt that he truly had gotten through to God, and yet there was something in him that always terrified him. What if it's not real? What if I'm fooling myself? What if I really am old Gheorghe in here, and I'm just fooling myself because everything's good? What'll happen next time somebody makes me mad? He couldn't get the image of his out of his mind of himself and the chainsaw cutting that door down and coming in after those guys. And he went through instruction class twice. This is like a couple years later, and the men from church would say, "Brother Gheorghe, you need to be baptized and join church." And he's like, "I'm not ready for it yet." But he didn't tell him what he was scared. He was scared of himself. In the meantime, he wasn't sitting still. He never has sat still. He talks 100 miles an hour, really loudly, and he was not sitting still. One of the things that's also true of the Roma in Romania is that they're very, very. They've experienced a lot of bias and a lot of racism, and in school, for example, they are while attendance is obligatory, learning is not necessarily, and if they work really hard and pay attention, and they can learn, but nobody's going to sit around and double-check on them. If you are a Roma child in a Romanian school, you're on your own. And so a lot of them maybe exit school at 12th grade if they don't drop out first, knowing to do nothing more than sign their name. And so because of that, there's just a real culture of ignorance, and it's just a self-repeating loop. And so Gheorghe got this bright idea of let's make like primer schools, ABC schools, after schools for children who want to learn. And so they started this. And there are now, the program is still ongoing. There's around 300 Romanian gypsy students that are still enrolled in the state school. But after school, they come to these little schools that are sprinkled around different villages, and they get actual teaching. So they can actually learn. It's a pretty high bar. You have to want it, and you have to work hard when you're there. But Gheorghe helped set that up. And the way they did it at first is they just rented rooms from people. Now they have them in a little schoolhouses everywhere. But at that point, they just rented rooms from people. One of the people that they rented from was this lady who turned out to be a really difficult person. And when it would be time for... They had made an agreement on rent, but she kept that as a moving target. So rent was this, but in the next month it's that, and then this isn't included and that's not included. And she was trying as hard as she could to get as much money as she could out of the system, and she was just challenging to work with. So finally they said, you know what, that's fine. We'll just build ourselves a little schoolhouse, and then we'll just move our schoolhouse out of your living room. And we'll move it over into this place. Well, she was frustrated then because she had killed the goose with the golden egg. But by that time, the goose is already on its way out. So one of the men, Marvin, asked Gheorghe to if he would help move the school. And so he said, sure, I'd be glad to. So they went over to this lady's place, and they were moving desks and chairs and tables and things out of this woman's house, loading them up. And Gheorghe was bent over, picking up this big table, and he had just bent way over, and this woman was beside him, the proprietress of the place, when all of a sudden, he got totally blindsided by just a tremendous clout across the side of the head. He said the birds sang and the stars were flying, and it was a little while before he could get his bearings, and he said, "Well, what was that for?" And she heard his voice, and she said, because she had hit Gheorghe. And she said, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I thought it was Marvin." And tells you a little bit about the personality that we're dealing with here. But he said, "That's okay, I'm glad to take one from Marvin." And then it struck him. And she was apologizing up and down and terrified. She normally wore these great big glasses, he said, and she had left them off. And so she just mistook this man-shaped object for Marvin, and was Gheorghe. She'd taken her glasses off and didn't realize whom she was hitting. And so just when you do hit people, make sure you wear your glasses. But she was apologizing and just desperately afraid. And he said it just struck him. And he was almost singing with joy. He said he couldn't stop because there was nothing there. Nothing. That anger, that rage that should have just boiled to the surface about the injustice of this brutish woman was gone. Nothing. He was so excited, he just felt like flying. He went right out. He told Marvin, "Hey, Marvin, baptize me." He's got a beautiful testimony to this day. Two of his children are getting married next month when we head back. God can do a work in our lives that we could never do on our own. A work that's above our possibility to imagine and above our power to perform. But it's always by the way of the cross. One of the things that's so intrigued me is this idea that Jesus had in Luke 9, where he said to them all, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. And, you know, I think I've said this here before, but this thought has stayed with me. It's interesting that Jesus does not say, take up your cross daily and crucify yourself. You see, it's impossible to crucify yourself. Do the math once. How would you do that? So, you girls, how is Jesus crucified? How do we know that what does the Bible say in the way that Jesus was crucified? Where were the nails? In his hands? And where else? In his feet. I want you to try to think of how you could possibly crucify yourself. Could you bend over and pound the nail through your foot? Yeah, you could sort of do that, okay? Now what about, could you get one of your hands? Maybe, right? I've got a free hand over here. It's impossible for us to crucify ourselves. And when we try to take control of our own redemption, we are half crucified. What a way to live. But what Jesus says is take up your cross and follow. So in other words, enter into the road which will lead in your crucifixion. Enter into the road, into the process that will end in your death. But Jesus, God, is the one in charge of that process, not me. So what it does is it means, what is that process? Well, what's in front of us? What's the thing that you are confronting right now that God wants to do in your life? What buzzard body part do you see in yourself? Is it lust, or is it anger, or is it unforgiveness, or bitterness? Or, you know, what is that thing that you just can't seem to rise above? When we try to crucify it ourselves, we're half dead. But when we pick up our cross, which means confronting that thing, moving toward that thing, but then realizing that that God is the one who can give us that healing. I can't do it myself. Then God does a work that is above my power and beyond my ability to imagine. That's the process by which we change exponentially. And one of the things that's always been intriguing to me is how quickly the vocabulary of the disciples and of the early church became this vocabulary of the cross. And it seems so counterintuitive. In fact, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 1:17, "For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. Unto the Jews a stumbling block, unto the Greeks foolishness, but unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. That's the preaching of the cross. Now, why should they talk like that? Why would they talk like that? We know it to be true, but what made it so vivid for them? And one of the answers, I think, for me is this. The disciples, Paul not so much, but the disciples knew Jesus before he was crucified. And they knew him as this amazing person. He healed the sick. He raised the dead. He turned water to wine. He walked on water. He stilled storms. He cast out demons. He was incredible. He was the most incredible person you'll ever meet. And Jesus is always talking here, especially at the end of his ministry, about this idea of taking up the cross and following. And how he's going to have to die the death of the cross. And then he says, what I do, you're going to have to do. And they're like, eh, maybe not. In fact, Peter says, far be it from you. And then it happens. The unthinkable happens. And Jesus dies the death of the cross. And it all comes collapsing down. And all the things that they thought to be true and the ways they had constructed a reality around Jesus just fell away with his death. Except, of course, that it didn't. Because, like Jason said this morning, Easter is coming and Easter makes all the difference. And Easter came and Jesus rose again, indisputably and absolutely. They saw him, they touched him, they spoke with him. And this Jesus, who was so incredible before, he's the same and yet he's not. If he was incredible before, what is he now? He's God. And the way they saw him just shattered and became so much more. And I think what they did is they started thinking back to his words and his preaching about the cross. And they've suddenly realized that the cross is the path. Death to self is the path. Giving up everything is the path to that. And when Jesus said, as I am, you will be, they said, oh, I get it now. And so they embraced the cross. And they embraced the idea of giving up themselves completely to that Easter moment. And the door to that Easter moment was, of course, the cross. And so it became something very exciting for them. And death truly did lose its sting for them. They became fearless and fierce, and they turned the world upside down through the power of Christ that was in them. It's incredible. And so many times, we don't share that perspective. And we think about the cross we have to carry. And it's like, okay, so I'm a Christian, so yeah, part of being Christian is you got to carry the cross. And we sort of grudgingly hold it up, or maybe we prop it up so people can see how big a cross I have to carry. But no, it's flipped. The script is flipped. It becomes the path of our redemption and salvation. And we are powerless to change ourselves, just as Gheorghe was powerless to change himself. We can't think our way into the kingdom of heaven. We can't theologize our way into the kingdom of heaven. We have to be born again. We have to be changed. The buzzard somehow becomes the eagle. And it's done through the power of the cross. And it's going to be different for different of us. But I would challenge you, the thing that God has placed in front of you, that he says, Joseph, you and I both know that this should change. And we say, well, I haven't been able to change it. And he says, well, have you followed what I said in changing it? Or are you trying to do this yourself? Concrete steps, steps into repentance, steps into confession, steps into forgiveness, steps into the heart of God, one step at a time, carrying that cross daily, we become more and more and more into the image of Christ. God does that work. We don't have possession of it. We only get to engage in it. I'm going to touch on two and then briefly on the other two points. You can experience the fruit of the Spirit in any stage in your life. I believe this to be true. Now, Jason talked this morning about a terrible stage in life, an unimaginable stage in life, in which a parent loses a child. And there, many of you here in this audience have experienced grief in deep, deep ways. And to say that you can experience the fruit of the Spirit in any stage of your life is not a denigration or a minimizing of that grief. But it is, I think, an exaltation of the power of God that can, by his supernatural power and by his Spirit, cause us to rise above and live in the fruit of the Spirit at any stage in our lives. And that's not to minimize in any way the things that we pass through. Galatians 5, I want to just read this. The fruit of the Spirit is love. It's joy. It's peace. It's long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law, and you can have it all right now. But you can't have it by self-discipline. You can't have it by hard work. You can't have it by lifting yourself up by your own bootstraps. It only comes by the Spirit of God. It only comes as we give ourselves to God. And as we give ourselves to God, we give ourselves to our brothers and our sisters. We don't give it to own it so that we can experience the blessing of it. We give it because God is in us. And when he is in us, he changes us so we no longer are too worried about ourselves. Now we share the vision of Christ. And I would just challenge us in reading through that list in Galatians 5, the list of the fruit of the Spirit, and then thinking back to what Jesus said about make the tree good and its fruit's going to be good. If we don't experience something like that, if we don't have joy, rather than saying, well, of course I don't have joy because of him, if you knew him and you had to live with him, let's see you try on joy. See how it fits you. But we switch that narrative and we say, you know what? The Spirit of God can give me joy. And I choose to follow the Spirit of God. And we all live that way. We become a community of people whose lives are based on the life that is within us, not simply on trying our best to have joy when it's so hard to have joy. And just simply being a community of good people trying to do good things. We can do better than that. We can't. Christ can. And then finally, the last two, if you lose your peace with God, that's on you. That's not your circumstances. That's not someone else. We have to give it up to lose it. And these are two aspects of the fruit of the Spirit, but I've just chosen these two. They're all true. But so many times when we lose our peace with God, it's easy to blame those around us, whether it's somebody we love or somebody we feel should love us, or our circumstances, or just a stage we are in life, or just, I'm having a bad day. And we lose our peace with God, but we've got a reason, we've got a rationalization for it. And realizing that that's not necessary. I had to give it up. I did that. I let it go. And repent of that. Living in Christ gives us peace. John 14 says, "These things have I spoken unto you," this is Jesus, "being yet present with you. But the Comforter, which is the Holy Ghost, whom the Father will send in my name, he shall teach you all things and bring all things to remembrance whatsoever I have said unto you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And this ties directly back to what the first commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Don't give it up. And then the second, if you lose your love for your brothers, that's on you. It's not them. It's not your circumstances. I had to give it up. And we take ownership of that. We don't make excuses. We don't rationalize. "By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have love one for another." Not if you get along with each other when you're treated right. Not even if you are exceptionally good at holding your temper when things are really trying. But they have genuine love for each other. And if we lose that, to go back, remember, we can't force that. That's something that comes from a walk in the Spirit. I think, for me, these four things have been transformative. God can do a work in your life that's above your ability to imagine, beyond your power to perform. You can experience the fruit of the Spirit in any stage in your life, no matter what you're going through. If I lose my peace with God, that's on me, not my circumstances, not someone else. I had to give it up to lose it. If I lost my love for my brothers, that was on me. It wasn't them. It wasn't my circumstances. It wasn't someone else. I had to give it up to lose it. And I close once again with Isaiah 40, verse 31. "They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. And they shall walk and not faint." Brother Gordier had already given up on himself. He knew he was done. He had seen the worst in himself and realized that he wasn't good enough. He had tried the best he could, and it wasn't enough. And his brothers pursued him for a month, sneaked into his house and turned the lights out to tell him something different. God's changing people all around us. He can change people in your life. What lengths are you willing to go to help those two people, Jesus Christ and that person in your life, connect? Shall we stand for prayer?